At the dawning of the 20th century, we discovered that certain organisms killed bacteria. 30 years later, we parlayed that discovery into the first antibiotic. Armed with that antibiotic, and the many others that followed, we happily populated the earth, much like mold in a petri dish. This leads us to ask, from where do antibiotics come, and will they come in time?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 516th edition of the Food Chain Radio program. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in Luganville who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Dave Michaels on the boards. Folks, you've heard the expression, live by the sword, die by the sword. Well, try this one on for size. Live by the antibiotic, die by the antibiotic. Yes, antibiotics have made it possible to live through many of the bacterial infections that took down our ancestors, and our populations have exploded across the earth as a consequence of that. But the fact is, we have used so much of so many antibiotics that bacteria are becoming resistant, and our hospitals are becoming breeding grounds for superbugs. Looking to the future, we pause to ask, from where do antibiotics come, and will they come in time? Here to lead the way, we have Charles Smith, Dr. Charles Smith, who's a pharmaceutical consultant and the author of The Process of New Drug Discovery and Development, which is now in its second edition, a monumental work on the development of new drugs. Why on earth did you write the book, Charles Smith?
Well, the first edition I wrote some years ago for investors who were looking at markets, and the second edition...
Oh, really? For people who are thinking about developing, the costs of developing a drug and whatnot?
Yes, the biotechnology industry was just getting underway. I had just retired after 36 years with major pharmaceutical companies, so I immediately was happily deluged by inquiries about how you conduct pharmaceutical research. The second edition is far more important. It's three times the size of the first, and it goes into the au courant sciences, which have expanded enormously in that period.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to have a link to this book on the webpage for people who are curious about it, so they can go there and look it up. But so I noticed from your biography on the back of the book that you've worked with almost all of the major pharmaceutical companies throughout the years, Charles.
Well, I specifically did work as an employee for years at the Upjohn Company, also at E.R. Squibb and Sons, and with the prescription drug division of Revlon, the Revlon Healthcare Group, nothing mm-hmm. to do with makeup and so on, cosmetics. And in the latter two, I was the VP for R&D. Now, since retirement, quote-unquote, and getting into the biotech business, I have worked with a large number, I don't know, maybe 20, 25 biotech companies on the drugs that they were looking for and the kinds of drugs and mechanisms and how do you go about it.
Well, Charles, when did you start working in the pharmaceutical industry? About what year?
Just out of 1954. It was 54. The year I got my PhD degree. I went to the Upjohn Company. I was there for 14 years and was recruited to Squibb. I loved Upjohn, but I had a wonderful opportunity to become a VP at Squibb, which I did take. And I was with Squibb about the same length of time, about 13 years. And I was recruited by a friend from my Upjohn days who mm-hmm. had become the head of a new prescription drug division at Revlon.
So you kind of got around the industry and know it quite well. The reason I ask is because it seems like you were pretty much there to watch the evolution of this industry.
Absolutely.
Tell us a little bit about what it was like when you first entered and the difference between then and now.
Well, we were looking, and I happened to have gone into the antibiotic field in 1952. We were looking for new molecules that would kill organisms, especially so-called gram-negative. And if you like, I'll get into some of those details later. Mm-hmm. We were also interested in high blood pressure in the company. I was working there totally in antibiotics. And, of course, we didn't have the speed. We couldn't look at 100,000 chemicals at one time as we can now. But we had excellent up-to-date people and technology and equipment. And so we had a continuous flow of new antibiotics coming out of Upjohn. And one of them, I'll just, a personal story that made me very happy to have ever gone into this field. There was a 9-year-old boy in Boston who had an infection in the knee that was resistant to all known antibiotics at the time, and he was to have been amputated. The FDA allowed this professor of infectious diseases at Harvard, at that time he was pretty much a world leader, to call drug companies and say, do you have any drugs ready to go that inhibit this kind of organism? And we did, and it was one project that had been given to me personally when I joined the company. And sure enough, they did inhibit that staphylococcus, as I recall. And the FDA approved our sending him some of the drug, and the boy was cured.
And we went home with a leg.
Yeah, he went home with the leg. And we had a big party at Upjohn. We had his chart up on the wall, enlarged, of course, with a big red X at the date they were to have amputated him. And the fact that he went home 5 days later, and I looked at my four kids, I said to Angie, to my wife, if I never do anything of consequence again, it was worth getting a PhD to know that that little guy went home with his leg. And it was uphill from there. We looked at a broad spectrum types, different types of antibiotics, and out of those programs, I guess Squibb marketed perhaps 4 or 5. Wow. New antibiotics.
Well, let me, before we go on with this, I recently read a survey taken by a major newspaper, and they asked parents and children the same question. They asked, what was the most important discovery of our lifetimes? And the parents, almost all the parents, said antibiotics.
Mm-hmm.
But the children said, who knows what, Walkman or iPods or something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah.
Right?
So
tell us a little bit about the difference that antibiotics are making in the world that we live in.
Well, you can see it, unfortunately, right now, although history tells you the same thing. You look at Africa and a lot of parts of Asia, Latin America, places where people don't have or cannot get antibiotics, and you look at the death rates just as they were back in the 1940s. People with all kinds of infections that today can be cured if they are given the right antibiotic. It has been said that the two most important things since the 1920s for society have been cleanliness, getting sanitation into our lives, washing our hands and so on, and antibiotics.
And the two kind of go together, aren't they?
Yeah, that's right.
And it's really hard for people who, you know, have grown up with antibiotics, I suspect, to not take them for granted. But, boy, they truly are the wonder drug that has saved so many people and really has allowed the population of the world to blossom, I guess, much like mold in a petri dish, right?
Yes, that's true.
And you've worked in antibiotics, and of course we're going to go into the development of an antibiotic and kind of follow the process through, but you've also worked with cancer drugs.
Yes, I've done a lot of work with cancer, about half of my career. At Squibb, I also had major projects in mental disease and in cardiovascular disease. So I've worked seriously in a broad spectrum of fields. The major ones initially, antibiotics, and toward the end of my career, cancer, the middle of my career, cancer, in which I'm still involved today.
Wow. Okay, folks, this is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here. When we get back from the break, I'd like to ask if there's a difference in the development of these drugs before we go into specifically the development of antibiotics. We've got Charles G. Smith, Ph.D., who is a friend of mine and also the author of The Process of New Drug Discovery and Development, the second edition, in cooperation with James O'Donnell. Charles Smith has been in the pharmaceutical industry for many, many years and has worked with all of the top names in pharmaceutical development. And today he's talking to us about the development of pharmaceuticals and how we take a drug from its idea or its conception through to our medicine cabinets. Unfortunately, we're not able to take phone calls today, but you can always post your questions and comments on the forum page at metrofarm.com, and I'll bet Charles Smith would be happy to answer them there, because he is a corresponder. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson. We will be right back. Do stay tuned.
Water users, you can reduce your need for water by 30% and more, grow healthier plants, and get rid of calcium carbonate deposits, no, not by magic, by installing an Aquamax catalytic converter in your water line that will induce epitaxial nucleation. Listen.
My name is Dave. I'm from Las Vegas, Nevada. Well, my pool maintenance is virtually none. There's no scale buildup on the tile whatsoever. I just take a damp cloth every so often and wipe the tile down, and that's as much work as I have to do. I don't have to aerate my lawn at all now. I just fertilize once in the spring and once in the fall, and that pretty much maintains my lawn.
You can reduce your need for water by 30% and more, grow healthier plants, and eliminate calcium carbonate deposits just by installing an Aquamax on your water line. No chemicals, no filters. Explore the possibility. Go to MetroFarm.com, click on the Aquamax Water Saver banner, and save. That's MetroFarm.com.
We are back. Michael Olson here. This is The Food Chain. We're talking about the evolution of a drug from idea to medicine cabinet with Charles Smith, who's the author of The Process of New Drug Discovery and Development and also a consultant to the pharmaceutical industry. Charles, we were talking a little bit about how you have worked in a number of different fields. Is there a real big difference in the development of a drug, for example, for cancer, and an antibiotic?
Oh, yes, a very major. The antibiotics, you have a good record, a history, and we know that certain tests that you can do with them in a test tube or in a petri dish and then carry on to animal models of the mm-hmm. disease will reach the market. Now, in most cases, and that includes infectious diseases, only a small percentage, I've seen estimates of 10% or 20%, even that have passed the second phase of clinical trials, fail in the third phase. And by failing, I mean they can't be shown to be any better than a drug already there, or they're not as good. Now, today, in the cancer field, there's much more disparity between what you see in the laboratory. We can grow, and we did back in the 1950s, 1958, I started the Upjohn Company's cancer program, and we grow cancer cells in a test tube, and we get a lot of information from that, but killing the cancer cell in a test tube is not equivalent to killing it in an animal. Now, I'd like to
Just a second now. Yeah. What you just told us is that you can do it with bacteria in a test tube or a petri dish. You can test antibiotics, but you can't test cancer cells in the same way. What is the difference?
No, I'm sorry. I misled you. I mean is that the validity of the data collected, yes, we grow them in test tubes, and you can kill them in a test tube, and you can grow certain normal cells and show that your drug candidate is less toxic to them.
Mm-hmm.
But the meaning of those data and translating them to humans is different. In my experience, there's a much higher failure rate in the anti-tumor arena because it is so complicated in man and animals. Now, when you look for an antibiotic substance, you do have animal models. They don't all predict 100% for sure. But there is a goodly prediction. I don't know the percentage. My own guess from my experience would be 60%. Whereas in the cancer field, it might be more like 10%.
Wow.
And the reason for this is that the tumor cells are so complicated, and they are human cells. They are animal cells. So while they're doing something dastardly to the host, killing the host, spreading around the body, they are not recognized as foreign substances the way mm-hmm. most of the microorganisms
because are. Because they're part of our body.
That's right. They're human cells. I put it when I lecture on this subject. They're like a tough hooligan type who walks into the room with a couple of guns on and so on. That person's human, is of the same background as we, and is treated differently than we. You don't just throw them out immediately. You wait and see what they want. Now, in the cancer field, the animal models are very important. They don't predict as well, in my experience, as they do for infection, but they do predict sufficiently, and in fact, that's the only way we can go. Now, you will hear from animal activists that you don't need animals, and indeed animals slow down the discovery of anti-tumor drugs, and that they can be found and developed without giving the precursor compounds or the compound mm-hmm. to any living animal, and it just isn't true. If you think of the human body, each day the heart recirculates some 1,800 gallons of blood to an estimated 50 to 100 trillion cells. These cells talk to each other in an extremely complicated biochemical language, of which we know a small percentage. Now, there's no way you can replicate that. When you go to a computer, the old saying, garbage in, garbage out, you have to know what you want to put in, and computers are used, but they are not a substitute for animals.
Let me ask you this. Is there an alternative? Do you think that there is a viable alternative to using animals, Chuck?
Absolutely not. It really cannot be done. For example, I never see a protocol from activists that says, well, here's how we would do it. They just say you shouldn't do it the way it's being done. But I say, how would you select the first dose to give to a human? Now, what we do is determine the maximum dose that has no toxicity in three animal mm-hmm. species. Then we take 10% of that, give it to a human being once, then once a day for maybe 5 days, then twice a day, and slowly work up to how much the human can tolerate. And then you select a dose, which you know when you go in, except in the field of cancer, but when you go into the human, you know is not going to be highly unlikely that it will be very toxic. And there's no way to predict that. How would you do it? If you have a test tube, you put a new chemical, it's never been in an animal body, you put that new chemical in the test tube, and it kills a bacterium, and you say, great, that's the bacterium that causes pneumonia. Mm-hmm. Let's give it to pneumonia patients. How are you going to pick the amount you're going to give? How are you going to decide the route? Do we give this by mouth? Do we give it by injection? If it's by injection, do we just presume the muscle or the vein will tolerate it and stick some in and look to see what you can't do that?
Well, is there a way of doing it without hurting the animals? Like, can we put the animals, knock them out with a pain pill or something?
Well, you do, of course, try to give the least mm-hmm. pain to the animals. I never saw a mouse killed, for which I didn't feel sorry. They aren't out chasing us or bothering us.
I guess you might say they're serving us, right?
Yeah, that's right. And we do take a lot of precautions. For example, when you say an experiment, a particularly heavy-duty experiment, is over, you put them out with a compound that you inject, and they just fall over. You're petting the animal, or the dog usually, and they just drop over dead. But there is no alternative. If every canon around the world, all the laws, the Helsinki Accord of particular import, after what the Germans did in Germany with those experiments, has decried, it's an absolute requirement that you first test in animals. The FDA requires it.
Mm-hmm.
So even if somebody, if an activist became the head of the FDA, he or she couldn't say there will be no more animals. If you ever accomplish that, you would kill new drug discovery and development. You'd kill it. And believe me, 10 years from now, when the drug candidates in the current pipelines come on through, we'll be saying, where are the next batch? Where's the next batch coming down the pipe? And there won't be another batch because you can't do it without animals. Now, I do want to say this about cancer. We're seeing a huge gain from the research of the last decade in biotechnology. We now are able to identify targets in cancer. This particular gene is turned on or off in breast cancer. Then we can make what's called a monoclonal antibody. This is a large molecule, not the type we synthesize, that you have to inject. But that is extremely specific. It goes just after that piece of the metabolism that we know is unique, say, to a breast cancer.
So it's kind of like a smart bomb.
That's exactly right. And the patients feel much better with it. They get high percentage remissions, and they get them long, for a longer period of time. Most of the cancers are not curable, but some are. And you don't hear much about them only because they're the small incidents. They don't have the large numbers that we hear, breast, colon,
right,
kidney, gallbladder diseases that are very, very upfront because they are so serious.
Well, Charles, we're going to have to take a quick break, but when we come back, I'd like to get back to the antibiotics and take us on a ride of how antibiotics are manufactured. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson, question of the day. Should animals be used to test new drugs? What do you think? We're curious to hear. Log your questions in your comments to the forum page at metrofarm.com and let us know what you think. We will be right back. Please do stay tuned. We are back. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking with Charles Smith, who is the author of The Process of New Drug Discovery and Development, the second edition, and also you soloed the first edition, right, Charles?
That's right.
And who is this edition designed to talk to? I mean, I picked this book up and fell in love with it immediately and think I could spend about a year reading it.
Well, it's aimed at the young people coming into the field to introduce them to today's modern methods, the hazards of them and the pluses, and to inform them of what's going on in the industry, across the pharmaceutical industry.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, for some of the people in the industry who have the time, you know, to read such things. Everybody gets so busy, but I hope it's going to be of considerable use in medical schools, in schools that teach biochemistry and pharmacology, as well as in the pharmaceutical industry.
Well, Charles, take us back to when you first started working with Upjohn. You said you were working exclusively on antibiotics. And
right.
Take us on the development of a new antibiotic so that we can learn what that process entails.
Yes. Well, when Fleming and his colleagues in England discovered penicillin, which was the first major antibiotic.
That was in the 30s, 1930 or something like
yes,
that?
Yes, yes, late 30s, I think.
Not too long ago, was it?
No, that's right, and it was so scarce that they would treat patients, and if the patient recovered, well, they didn't know if they'd recover yet, they'd collect the urine and extract the penicillin that comes out in the urine, purify it, and use it on another patient.
And that was because they could not manufacture
it? Yeah, they couldn't make it.
Wow.
Now, that Fleming showed that a mold, a penicillium mold, made something that killed bacteria that was growing around it, and that kicked off everything. So all the companies put up big screens, we call them, and the screens in antibiotics include, as they are today, are done in vitro, in test tubes. Now, Upjohn, and all the drug companies then, would up the rate of throughput by taking, if you can imagine, a flat plate, straight plate that's a foot wide, 2 feet long, and on that we would spray with just paint sprayers soils, and we'd collect soils from different places, the backyard, Guam. We collected some from the atomic bomb proving sites in Alamogordo, New Mexico. And the reason for this was the idea that certain environments put certain pressures on the organisms. So what's growing 15 years after you've bombed it and is still so radioactive, you can hardly bring it into the laboratories to work on. And what is growing today in the rainforest ought to be very different bugs. Mm-hmm. So those are taken up. You take out the organisms that show some evidence on that spray jar of being able to kill a bacterium. And you look at spectrums. So you look at, there are so-called gram-positive organisms. Graham was a man who discovered the way to test for them. And gram-negative. The gram-positives are, I think, more prevalent and up to now have been much simpler to treat. And you so rightly said in the beginning, now we have a hospital problem because we're down to only one major antibiotic that is still effective, and we have a lot of staph infection in the hospital. So be rest assured that the industry searching very rapidly and hard for this, focused on it, but it's been difficult to accomplish. But now we go on, you look at some that have, you look for antibacterial gram-negative so that you have what we call a broad spectrum. You will take only staphylococcus if it inhibits the resistant organism. Or you want medium spectrum, which is the strep staphylococcus and some of the other gram-negatives that will be more responsive. And then, of course, if you have those that will kill Pseudomonas, which is a very, very difficult thing to treat, that's going to get top priority. And what you do is go into the test tubes I mentioned, then into animal models. You have animal models of a wide spectrum of diseases. But, of course, first you look for the toxicity. Mm-hmm. And see whether how much an animal can tolerate and what happens when they can't tolerate it. If the new substance just wipes out the liver or the bone marrow, those are going to be too toxic substances at any dose to use in a human. And even if you didn't think so in your wisdom, the company couldn't risk going forward with them because, of course, anybody who sued would say, look, you knew that could cause bone marrow depression, blah, blah, blah.
Class action lawsuit.
Yeah, right. So then you go through that animal tox and you say the pattern looks acceptable for an antibiotic. Then you go into the disease models and you give the antibiotics, or you want most of them to be oral. Some of them aren't. They mm-hmm. can only work when they're injected.
What is the difference between an oral drug and an intravenous drug?
Well, the oral drug you take by mouth, of course, and you get enough absorbed from the stomach and able to pass through the liver, which is a big metabolic organ,
right,
to get into the blood in high enough concentrations. An intramuscular is still fairly easy to give to the patient, but it's more trouble, and of course for kids it's terrible.
Painful.
Intravenous is the most difficult because you have to get down into a vein, and you have to do that every time you want to give a dose.
So when you're giving a drug intravenously, you're essentially bypassing the internal organs, right?
That's right. You're putting it directly into the blood. See, our body is made up so that when something comes into the mouth, food or anything else, the stomach starts to work on it to digest it. The small intestine definitely digests it. The digested pieces are absorbed along with those that haven't been changed and go to the liver. The liver is the most active metabolic organ in the body. And so it rejects some of these and just chews them up, puts them in the meat grinder. Mm-hmm. Others, it warns you by various tests that you can do, this going up from the liver, enzymes going up, and so on. But you get a picture when you get to steady state so that you're putting it in by whatever route and you have it in the body for several hours. Then you look for its metabolites. So you take urine and feces and blood and you extract from that, having given a radioactive drug to the animal. You extract and you study, what does the liver do to that? Does the unchanged drug come out in the liver and go into the blood, or is the liver modifying it, maybe to a more active, but more likely to an inactive form? And then you pick your leads according to what they can do, so you can make sure they get from the mouth into the blood or from the injection site right. into the blood. Then you get prepared for phase one clinical studies. Now, up to now, you've had mostly pharmacologists, biochemists, toxicologists, and pharmacists, just like your corner drugstore, but a research pharmacist who's putting together the formulation so that it'll be stable enough to give to a human and not disintegrate sitting around on the shelf. Now you do a phase one clinical trial, and that involves usually about 50 patients, but starts with, volunteers, but it starts...
Charles, before we go into the phase one, we're going to have to take a quick break. And,
okay.
Folks, this is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking with Charles Smith, author of The Process of New Drug Discovery and Development. We're talking about the development of new antibiotics, and Lordy knows, we're going to need them. Will they come in time? 800, whoops, no phone numbers today, but you can always reach us on the forum page at metrofarm.com. Do stay tuned. Right back.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of Metro Farm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. Metro Farm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. Metro Farm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. Metro Farm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of Metro Farm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Welcome back, folks. This is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking about the process of new drug discovery and development with its author, Charles Smith. And specifically, we're talking about the development of antibiotics. That being just one of the many drugs that Charles Smith has worked on, but one really indicative of the process of new drug discovery and development. Charles, we talked about going into phase one, and
right.
that means that we're out of the laboratory and into the bodies, right?
That's right, and we start at, as I said before, one-tenth of the maximum no-effect dose in three species and give that once to a volunteer,
mm-hmm.
usually males, because...
Where do you find volunteers to take new drugs?
Oh, you advertise on TV, on the radio, you send out flyers. It's, my wife, my kids, did it all the years I was at the company.
Oh, your wife and kids did it?
Yeah, sure, and it's a big business, and there are a lot of volunteers, and it's been amazingly safe, thank God. There have been, I don't even know of a catastrophe, you know, where several uh-huh. people died.
Well, it must be pretty safe if you're, you know, giving it to your wife and children.
Well, that's right. And in those days, we the scientists, with the exception of the cancer drugs, which were always very toxic in and mm-hmm. of themselves, we took those drugs. We took each other's blood and measured how much went in and so on. Somebody, a lawyer somewhere, put an end to that. So now what we have is you have places that people can go off the site. They don't work directly for the company. But you go in and determine how much is absorbed. You measure it in the urine, in the blood, in the feces. As I said before, you see whether or not you can show the parent molecule being circulated around. And you'll do that for one dose one day, then maybe one dose for 5 days, or 3 days and 5 days, a few volunteers on each. Until you've gotten to the point that you feel the amount you're giving, based on what you've done in the animals, should be adequate. And now you shift the gears to phase two, which is the patient studies.
Mm-hmm.
And you start again with a lower than expected dose and raise it slowly. And here you're observing all aspects of the patient's behavior and response to this compound. And the first phase, I think, might take about 50 volunteers, maybe more. Then phase two clinical, probably a total of 500 to 1,000, more like 500, I'd say. And then phase three is somewhere between 1,000 and perhaps 5,000. Now, at this point in time, it takes 10 to 12 years and costs $1 billion, with a B, dollars, for each prescription drug that makes it to the market.
Wow.
So you're talking a huge expense in doing this. Yes, there are at times toxicity to the patients from the drug, but it's not the kind that you would get if you tried to just take a chemical off the shelf and inject it into people without using animals.
Well, essentially we're spending 10 years and $1 billion.
That's right.
To make sure that that the drug works, one, and that it won't harm anybody, too.
Absolutely, and that's the piece of the action that's so important, is to show both the efficacy and the of it.
Mm-hmm.
And you have everybody alert. You don't use pregnant women, of course. You have everybody who's handling the patients and the patients alert to the fact that they should report anything that seems abnormal. Now, to do a clinical study is a big affair. You'll read a lot of things in the magazines and papers today, clinically proven to do X, Y, Z. Well, in the pharmaceutical industry, clinically proven means that you do what's called a double-blind, randomized, placebo-controlled trial. Now, that means randomized. The patient walks in. The doctor has the equivalent of, say, a deck of cards with 26 number ones and 26 number twos shuffled up, turns that over, and you get bottle one or two.
Mm-hmm.
One of those bottles is the active drug. The other is an inactive placebo. Or if you must use another drug as well, something else other than a placebo, it's another drug. Neither the doctor nor the patient knows who's getting the drug and who's getting the placebo. And at the end, when the evaluations are made, it has to have enough patients to give statistical analysis. And you see almost none of that outside the prescription drug field because it's so enormously expensive.
And
but that's the way you prove efficacy.
Sure. And there's no way that you can afford to prove the efficacy in that way.
That's right.
Unless you have some kind of way of controlling the costs, right?
That's absolutely right.
Unless you have a patent or can somehow own it, there's just no way that you can prove
that's
the efficacy.
That's absolutely right. And all of us decry the cost of drugs. But I warn the public that if the people who say we just ought to import our drugs from 14 countries, Canada, the UK, India, they'll be much cheaper. But I'm saying to you, you better think about 10 years from now when our new drug pipelines are dried up because you can't afford to do it. Who's going to provide you with the next round of new drugs? They certainly aren't going to come from most of these countries that they're talking about importing from now.
Well, and we're going to take a quick break here in just a moment, but when we come back, I'd like to ask you, what about those new drugs in the pipeline? We were talking a little bit earlier about facing the situation where we're looking at a superbug in our hospitals that only one antibiotic can manage.
Right.
And how long will it be before the superbugs learn to outduel that particular antibiotic, and then what do we do then?
Yeah.
Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking about the evolution of antibiotics with one of the people who evolved them, by golly, Dr. Charles Smith, author of The Process of New Drug Discovery and Development. We're not taking phone calls today, but you can always work with us by logging on the forum page at metrofarm.com. We will be right back. Please do stay tuned. Welcome back, folks. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson. We're talking antibiotics with Charles G. Smith, author of The Process of New Drug Discovery and Development. Dr. Smith, we use a lot of antibiotics. Not only do we treat almost everything with it ourselves, but we also feed it to our animals in our animal factories to help them grow. So we're kind of inundated, I guess, as it were, but with antibiotics in our culture. And the incredible amount we're using seems to be breeding resistance in the bacteria themselves. We're facing a situation with respect to our hospitals where there is a superbug, a staphylococcus, that is resistant to all but one antibiotic. What are we going to do? Where are we going to go?
Well, we do have to keep at a good rate doing what we're doing, and that is making that resistant organism the primary target. Now, with respect to whether or not, and it seems to me that feeding to cattle and so on might well be hazardous, but there are a lot of articles that say that isn't so. The reason for the hospital environment is, of course, there's so much exposure and there's so much illness that in the hospitals they get resistant to the most effective antibiotics. But I don't have an answer to that. That's not my field of expertise, epidemiology. But I sure do watch and hope that we're going to begin to see now antibiotics from the efforts of the last 5 years that are that to which the bug is not resistant. The hospital-borne infections are not resistant. And there you will look for oral or injectable or even intravenous, because it's so important to get that into control that the route of administration is less important. People won't reject an injection if they know that the answer might be if you don't take the injection, you don't get cured.
Wow. Well, we have about a minute left. Let me ask you a quick one. Will the new drugs coming out of genetic engineering, do they look hopeful to you?
Oh, yeah. They're the ones that are so specific. And for example, in arthritis, where you can bring down the arthritic joints to essentially normal, I won't say normal, but the patients just rave about the order of magnitude of the effect. Also now in breast cancer in women, and there are these immunology stimulators and inhibitors that are being worked on hot and heavy, and I'm confident that we're going to see in the next decade, and certainly the next two decades, tremendous improvements in the selectivity of our treatments.
Well, Charles Smith, we're out of time, but thank you so much, folks. This has been The Food Chain. We've been talking about the process of new drug discovery and development with the author of that book, Charles G. Smith. Thank you so much for tuning in. Remember the question of the day: should we use animals to test new drugs? On the forum page at metrofarm.com. Charles Smith, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for the opportunity.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.